DW Africa Link.
Today, we direct our attention to South Sudan, a nation in the grip of fresh turmoil. The recent charging of First Vice President Riek Machar with treason, murder, and crimes against humanity over the March White Army militia attacks in Nasser has escalated the crisis. Machar, who has been under house arrest since March, denies those charges, as does his party, the SPLM-IO, who see them as a ploy to weaken the 2018 peace deal. The opposition has urged citizens to resist what they see as an attempt to impose one tribe rule, raising fears that the fragile stability achieved since the civil war could be in jeopardy. That's what's coming up. Stay tuned as we explore this critical situation. My name is Josephine Mahachi. Welcome to Africa Link, the podcast that connects you to the stories that matter from and on Africa.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
The roots of the current crisis trace back to South Sudan's long-standing power struggle between President Salva Kiir and his rival Riek Machar. Their rivalry ignited the devastating 2013 to 2018 civil war, largely fought along ethnic lines between Kiir's Dinka and Machar's Nuer communities, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions. A fragile 2018 peace agreement brought Machar back as first vice president, but mistrust has persisted with delayed reforms and sporadic clashes straining the deal. The latest flashpoint came in March 2025 when fighters from the Nuer White Army militia attacked Nasser, prompting the government to accuse Machar of orchestrating the assault, charges he and his supporters reject as a bid to sideline him and tighten Kiir's hold on power. Now, to discuss this further, I'm joined by DW's correspondent Michael Atit and Stephen Robomusa, the regional director of SEPO, a community empowerment organization focused on progress. I'll start with you, Michael Atit, as our correspondent. If you can walk us through the events leading to Riek Machar's indictment and house arrest, and also just a brief overview of exactly what is happening in the country.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. What is happening in South Sudan is even surprising to many South Sudanese after the what is so-called a revitalized peace agreement that has been signed in 2018. And then after the formation of the National Transitional Government, many South Sudanese were hopeful that everything is going to be okay. But then at a certain point, the national government started also dragging their feet among themselves. There has been some accusation against the SPLA-IO, which is one of the signatories of the peace agreement, that they are supporting some local militias deep into the Upper Nile, that this militia group is linked to First Vice President Riek Machar, even though the IO or the Machar himself repeated this on several occasions, that his troops have nothing to do with this local militia group. So in March, people just got surprised with the government that the Machar is having a link, and top other officials from the SPLM-IO, including the Minister of Petroleum, that they have a link with the militia, what's so-called White Army in Upper Nile, and that the event took place. The White Army had attacked the military in Nasser, and a lot of bloodshed happened there. So from that moment, the government started arresting Machar and other group, and also put them in the house arrest. That story that came out. But then people are cautious. People are asking themselves, now Machar has been indicted. Machar has been accused. Machar is going to the court. Now, how will be the possibility of implementing the peace agreement from now onwards. Since the other party is already being convicted or is being charged with so many crimes, how are you going to continue implementing this peace process on your own going forward? That is the big question that many South Sudanese are asking. We are still waiting, as many South Sudanese are waiting, to see the announcement of when the process, the procedure for the for the court is going to start. So that is the scenario currently we are in.
Right. Now, turning to you, Stephen, from looking at the civil society organizations, I also don't know if you want to add something from what Michael has said, but how are the civil society organizations navigating this tense environment? Are they able to operate freely and advocate for peace and justice?
Thank you so much for this. And I like the narrative that my colleague Michael has put, and that is exactly the situation on ground. In reality, when it comes to the civil society operation across the country, it is limited. As long as you do your work far from advocacy and talking on issues to do with the attitude of the politics and current situation, I think you are safe. You can operate within that. But there's a lot of risk. The entire can become too sensitive to anything that we are doing as a member of the civil society. So we have very few individuals or organizations so that they are able to raise their voices. But those voices are calculated. So some of our colleagues in the other states, they cannot really operate freely as it is, simply because, you know, the current situation is too complex and predictable. And it's not easy really to operate as a free civil society who might be doing the governance or peace building program. So once you come to that advocacy things, raising critical issue, now you become a target.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the peace agreement itself. I mean, obviously, as activists, you advocate for peace, you advocate for justice, you advocate for at least human rights to be respected in different communities. But do you foresee this happening, Stephen, in South Sudan?
When if you take the revitalized peace agreement, we have it stuck. We are not moving on. And if we give the percentage before the arrest of Machar, we are considering it was 40%, you know. But by now, we're talking about less than 40, 30, maybe 25, looking at the agreement, because now it's become like only a one party who dominating everything. And that put the entire agreement in very difficult situation, you know. So that is one thing when you talk about the revitalized peace agreement. And then you have also subnational conflicts that also take a lot of energy and a lot of resources as well, you know, is unresolved, because that one is interconnected with having the national peace and peace agreement. If you do that one implement and everything will be okay. So it is, again, things are not easy as in the way how we can perceive. You know, we advocate, yes, we call for women rights, yes. But if you look at the higher leadership, especially the states level, where all the governorship have been managed by men. Though Espalem Ayo, out of the three states, were having one female after being removed, replaced by men. So the entire states have been managed by men. So parties even themselves, they are not adhering to what they have inked to, you know. So it is not an easy process. So, yeah.
Now to you, Michael. Just to find out also even the response from the citizens themselves, if they believe the charges against Machar are justified, are they politically motivated, or I don't know, just to ask what people are saying, do these charges reflect genuine accountability efforts?
Yeah, maybe to answer that question, we I have to look a little bit back. It has been not a secret anymore that on the personal level between President Kiir and Riek Machar, There are a lot of differences. These two men don't come like together. And even the followers have been saying this. And so anything in that regard, people also look at the, you know, at the ethnical background, where President Kiir is coming from, and also where Riek Machar is coming from. So it becomes also like a battle between two ethnical groups. That situation is very strong there, and it is very significant also on the shaping the politics in South Sudan. So if you look, to answer your question, if you look at the charges put against Machar, the timing of the charges itself, it's has a lot of question. At the time where the two parties or even the other signatories are supposed to, by now, would have been fully implemented the peace agreement, and now people would have been talking about the new elected government since 2022 forward. But now we are still, again today, talking about a full implementation of the peace agreement, and as maybe Stephen put it, even 60 or 70% of this peace agreement has not yet been implemented. So if you put this together, looking at the charges at this time, you look at it as something politically motivated. You smell something political there, because as people are moving towards December 2026, where the anticipated national election is coming, there are a lot of political maneuver, political movement that is supposed to take place. So it seems like the government maybe wanted to sideline, to cripple down the SPLA-IO so that they go to national election in December 2026, where they see no any party like to contest or any party like to challenge them in this credibility of the election that is coming. So this is not a secret anymore. This is an open secret for many South Sudanese that this charge is put against Machar and his colleagues are politically motivated.
Now, Stephen, from your end as well, what has been the reaction from a civil society and ordinary citizens to this development? And what are the, you know, possible scenarios for South Sudan in the coming months? Are we looking at escalation, negotiation, or reform?
Yes. Yeah. You know, the fact remain the same. As a member of the civil society, we have been very clear from day one that the two parties are able to work together. And this is what we have learned, even at the state level. You see very clear where the chief governor from Ayo, you have the deputy who might be from Espalem. You don't have that respect for one another. That shows sorry, they were unable to work together. Though we have, welcomed the legal procedure, because I've been saying, as members, okay, if there's any criminal charges against Machar, then let it be pronounced so that the public know, and let that be, in transparent manner, so that he be able to defend himself with his lawyers to claim, because he has been there in confinement for a good number of months. So another. Now the fear is, as Akil said, the timing of this pronouncement has got a negative reaction among the community. And people already taking from that tribal angle. That is our fear. So the possibility of having violence in the country is higher, because the way how you hear people around the way how you monitor the young people in social media can tell you exactly if this process has been well managed. I think it's become an issue. And that's why you have got the religious leaders become very clear. They're calling the president on his own capacity as the higher authority in the country to to take another way, to look at the issue of reconciliation and forgiveness, so that the country shouldn't take, get back to total violence where we had to handle.
And Stephen, still with you, what impact could international pressure or sanctions have on the government's handling of opposition voices, in your opinion?
I think the pressure at a certain moment, a certain point, it did help a certain point. But what we have learned from the regional international communities, I think there's issue for the interest here. I think they have low interest in South Sudan and have to put an end to this. Because also we've had this issue of the sanction, we hear about those threats. But when it comes to the practical things, it's not so effective. I think there's something need to be done more than that. We believe in having an engagement that goes beyond a sanction, something that goes beyond on the pressure. It is something that's really tangible, so that we have a solution to this. Because how many sanctions so far have been put on some individual, but they still continue serving in the government. They still continue doing with the same business as usual. So there's something to be done more than that. That's why we as a member of the civil society, keep on pushing on what is so-called the homegrown solution. How can the civil society be empowered together with religious leaders? How to come push harder from their own perspective? Because it is where we live. It is where we have the future of the coming generation. So it is our country at the end of the day. We need to take the kind of ownership so that we push our leaders to go for peaceful solution instead of confrontations.
Right. And Michael, what does this mean for the SPLM AIO's role in the peace process? I hear both of you keep talking about, obviously, the peace agreement and also looking at the upcoming elections.
A few days ago, there was a statement issued by the acting chairman of the SPLM IO, and we have seen those statements circulating on social media. They have stated clearly that the peace agreement is no longer legitimate because the government party, the SPLM IG, for example, decided to eliminate them from the process and decided to put their chairman into house arrest and taking him through this court process. So for SPLM IO, at this time, for them, they think the peace process is already dead. And even within the SPLM IO house itself, they are now splitted into two. And politically, if you look at it very keen, that is already a weak point, because if the IG is able to divide their house into two groups, that means there is no unity. There is no they are no longer stronger in the political sense. So the government is trying to now to go forward. To implement the peace agreement with the other split group, which is a little bit going to get a lot of difficulties and challenges ahead, because the signatories to the agreement is in the name of Machar, and they have a lot of a say in implementation of the peace agreement, in the decision, into issue of the trust building, issue of reconciliation and all. But with this new group coming in, I think they are going to get a lot of challenges ahead of the time, if not now, but at least before election or even during the election time, there will be a lot of issues.
Right. And how is the local media, Michael, covering this crisis? Are journalists facing pressure or censorship in the country?
Our hope in media field is this process should be open to the media. We should get a free space, a free environment where journalists are able to cover the process ethically. They are able to interview the accused. They are able to interview maybe defense personnel. They're able to interview even to get reaction of the citizens, because the South Sudanese have a lot in them to say about what the process is going on. But if the government decided to block the media or decided to put some restrictions in this process, definitely will have an impact even on the ground, on South Sudanese. What I would like to encourage South Sudanese not to do is the social media propaganda. We have seen, even during the Nasser incident, we have seen a lot of videos and images on social media, even some of them in the local dialect that I cannot interpret, or some of, but you could see the body language telling you there is something wrong. We don't want to see that. You know, we don't want to see that, because as long as that continues, that would agitate a lot of incitement, and that would definitely lead to another crisis that the country like South Sudan does not want this at this time, because we have, our people have suffered enough, and I think there is a chance that our leaders need to do at least something tangible so that South Sudanese enjoy their country, enjoy their independence. We are still proud of ourselves that we are an independent country, yes, and we are a news-created country in the world, yes. But then if you come on the ground and ask South Sudanese today, you might get a different story, and that is a little bit a setback to many South Sudanese.
Right, right. I was going to ask you to, as we conclude our discussion, to give some advice as a journalist to other journalists and other citizens. So you've already done that. Now, as we wrap up our discussion, Stephen, what would a peaceful resolution look like, and what steps are needed to get there?
I think I have seen the role of religious leaders in South Sudan has been so effective. You know, starting from the time of struggle, where the religious leaders have been in central, you know, positions, in discrediting and bringing people together. So I think this, for me, is a high time that the religious leaders, with their moral power, coming in to really engage our leaders in South Sudan, and with support of the civil society and the international community, so that we should be really a homegrown solution, so that which may lead us to permanent peace and stability in this country. And I would like to amplify what my colleague Michael said. I think some leaders manipulating young people who are, you know, behind the screen on social media, trying to, you know, promote this negative propaganda and escalating the, you know, the situation in the country. I think it is a high time that as young people in this country, they need to love their country. Yes, with the political leaders, they have their differences, they have issues among themselves, but the future of this country relies on the hands of the young people. And they have, you know, that responsibility to prepare the future that they are going for. If they mess it up, that is their country. Any step outside our border, you are a foreigner. So we don't want to be foreign again. You know, we have been refugees, so I've been outside this country, but it's the right time for us to build this country, regardless of what is happening.
DW's correspondent Michael Atit and Stephen Robo Musa, the SEPO Regional Coordinator, a Community Empowerment for Progress organization, many thanks for joining us. South Sudan's path forward depends on turning crisis into dialogue, much like Sierra Leone, Rwanda, and Liberia, which overcame deep divisions through reconciliation, reform, and inclusive governance. That's it for this edition of Africa Link. Remember, you are not just a listener, but a crucial part of our community, and your engagement is crucial in shaping the direction of our discussions. We value your insights and encourage you to share your thoughts with us. Remember, you can find all of the Africa Link podcast episodes on Spotify and Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts from. This episode was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. My name is Josephine Mahachi. Thanks for listening. Until the next one, it's bye for now.
DW, made for minds.